5:29 a.m., July 16th, 1945. A flash of light, brighter than a star, appears over the Jornada del Muerto Desert in New Mexico, bathing the surrounding mountains in a brief swath of light as bright as daylight, and sending out shockwaves that were felt over 100 miles away. This was the first nuclear test as part of the Manhattan Project, and in its wake left a 30-foot-wide crater in the desert floor. The sand melted to a light green glass known as trinitite, named specifically for the Trinity test, as this nuclear detonation was called. A description of the official report, filed by Thomas Farrell, said the following. The lighting effects beguiled a description. The whole country was lighted by a searing light with the intensity many times that of the midday sun. It was golden, purple, violet, gray, and blue. It lighted every peak, crevasse, and ridge of the nearby mountain range with a clarity and beauty that cannot be described but must be seen to be imagined. To all watching on that warm July morning, it was a beautiful sight to behold. A split atom releasing unimaginable force, lighting the morning sky with a mosaic of shimmering colors so beautiful, Ralph Carlyle Smith dropped the protective glass he was using to watch the test, in awe of what they'd created. Smith later wrote, "I dropped the glass from my left eye almost immediately and watched the light climb upward. The light intensity fell rapidly, hence did not blind my left eye, but it was still amazingly bright. It turned yellow, then red, and then beautiful purple. At first it had a translucent character, but slowly turned to a tinted or colored white smoke appearance. The ball of fire seemed to rise in something of a toadstool effect. Later, the column proceeded as a cylinder of white smoke. It seemed to move ponderously. A hole was punched through the clouds, but two fog rings appeared well above the white smoke column. There was a spontaneous cheer from the observers. Dr. von Neumann said, that was at least 5,000 tons, and probably a lot more." The official reports paint an astounding and triumphant picture. Years later, J. Robert Oppenheimer, one of the architects of the Manhattan Project, was less enthused. In an interview years after the war, Oppenheimer uttered perhaps the most famous recollection about the Trinity test.
"We knew the world would not be the same. Few people laughed. Few people cried. Most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. I suppose we all thought that one way or another."
Welcome to Let's Talk About. I'm your host, Jason Pajak, and today we begin another journey of discovery. This episode is the first part of a new series I'd like to call War Stories, where I will tell you the stories you don't often hear from blockbuster Hollywood productions, but ones that are darker, more poignant, and may make you question the toll war takes on those we send to fight it. In part one of this series, we will follow Colonel Paul W. Tibbetts, the man who killed 100,000. Before we begin, I want to make something clear. This is not meant to be a condemnation of Tibbetts or any other individual involved in the development or use of nuclear weapons. I've been to Hiroshima, stood in the shadow of the Peace Bell and stared across the river at the building above which the Little Boy bomb was detonated, ending 134,000 lives. I've seen the silhouettes burn forever into scorched concrete, the bloody rags from survivors whose skin peeled off in slabs, the rivulets of black soot rain stained on the remains of walls. At 17, in the guest book at the Hiroshima Museum, I wrote, "Scars never heal for wounds so deep." Tibbetts had his orders. Oppenheimer had his orders. President Truman had a war to win. A debate about what is right and wrong will always change through time and context. Who you are and the experiences you have impact how you perceive the world. This episode is meant to tell Tibbetts' story, nothing else. What you do with this information is up to you. So let's begin. Paul Warfield Tibbetts Jr. was born February 23, 1915 in Quincy, Illinois, though to say the man was really from anywhere would give the consistency of his upbringing too much credit. A son of Paul Tibbetts Sr. and Enola Gay Tibbetts, The family moved around a fair bit, and for various reasons. Paul Sr. was a confections wholesaler, and when Jr. was just 5 years old, the family relocated to Des Moines, Iowa, and then at eight, Paul Jr. was uprooted again and moved to Hialeah, Florida. Apparently, his parents had grown weary of the frigid Midwestern winters and wanted a bit of sunshine. It was while living in Hialeah where Paul Jr.'s love of flying really, for lack of a better term, took wing. He had loved flight from an early age, but in 1927, when Tibbetts was 12 years old, his mother, Enola, paid little Paul Jr. a dollar to jump into a plane flown by barnstormer Doug Davis at a carnival. Buzzing around in the great blue sea above, Tibbetts dropped candy bars attached to mini parachutes to the onlookers down below at Hialeah Park Racetrack. The family stay in Florida didn't last much longer, as the Tibbetts clan moved back to Illinois soon after, settling this time in Alton, Illinois, as his father sought greener business pastures. It was in Alton where Paul Jr. attended the prestigious Western Military Academy, a military prep school, and graduated in 1933. From there, Paul Jr. struck off on his own, moving back to Florida to attend the University of Florida, with the intention of becoming an abdominal surgeon. While living in Florida for the second time, Paul took flying lessons under the tutelage of Rusty Hurd at Miami's Opa-locka Airport. Now, these lessons are important to the course of history, because without them, Tibbetts may have continued down the medical path and become a wonderful abdominal surgeon. But after transferring to the University of Cincinnati, a little spark caught flame. Just over a year after starting at Cincinnati, Tibbetts pivoted, enlisting in the United States Army with the intention of becoming a pilot in the United States Army Air Corps. And he would get his wish. Because of his educational training and prior flight experience, Tibbetts qualified for the Aviation Cadet Training Program. Receiving his pilot rating in 1938, he was then commissioned as a second lieutenant and began his military career. Also in 1938, Tibbetts married Lucy Frances Wingate. And where did they get married? Holy Trinity, Alabama. History likes to wink at us sometimes. Over the next 7 years, Tibbetts worked his way up the military ladder, actually being assigned as General George S. Patton Jr.'s personal pilot in 1940 and 1941. He received training to fly B-18 bombers as well as B-17s during this time. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip over Tibbetts' involvement in the war against Germany, jumping straight to that fateful day in 1945. Imagine the scene. August 6th, a tiny island called Tinian. Tibbetts walks along the fuselage of his plane, running his hand along the cool metal siding, just below where Enola Gay, the name of his plane and his mother, is written on the side. The Enola Gay takes off from Tinian for the 6-hour flight to Japan, meeting up with the great artiste, piloted by Major Charles Sweeney, and the necessary evil, flown by Captain George Marcant. Sweeney's job was to measure the blast, Marcant's job was to observe and take photos. Tibbetts' job, drop the bomb. 8:15 a.m., Hiroshima time. Little boy is dropped from the Enola Gay. 44.4 seconds later, a bright flash appears 1,900 feet above the city. Little boy missed its target, the Aloy Bridge, due to crosswinds, but that didn't matter. An estimated 70 to 80,000 people, 30% of the city's population at the time, died from the blast alone. The Enola Gay, meanwhile, was 18 kilometers away when it finally felt the shockwave of the blast. Tibbetts later told a reporter, "It was hard to believe what we saw." William S. Parsons, who was on board the Enola Gay at the time and was the man responsible for arming the bomb, told the same reporter, "The whole thing was tremendous and awe-inspiring. The men aboard with me gasped, 'Oh my God.'" In total, an estimated 134,000 people died as a result of the bombing. The blast, the heat wave, and concussive force washing the city off the map, and the ensuing fallout, took 134,000 lives. After Hiroshima, Tibbetts continued his career in the military, retiring from the U.S. Air Force in 1966. In his post-military life, Tibbetts continued to fly, actually reenacting the bombing of Hiroshima in 1976 at an air show in Texas. This was something the U.S. government apologized to Japan over. Reportedly, the display was complete with a mushroom cloud and all. Paul Tibbetts Jr. died November 1st, 2007, in Columbus, Ohio, age 92. In the 62 years following the bombing, Tibbetts defended the United States' decision and his actions. Projections showed the casualties from continued fighting on the Eastern Front would have far eclipsed the lives lost in two nuclear bombings. But we'll never actually know. The debate about the necessity of both nuclear bombings continues to this day. And in 2018, the population of Hiroshima, Japan, was estimated to be almost 1.2 million. And that is the story of Paul Tibbetts Jr., the pilot of the Enola Gay and the man responsible, or tasked, would be a better term, with flying the little boy nuclear bomb over Hiroshima. As I mentioned in that little piece there, I myself have visited Hiroshima. I was in Japan when I was 17, and I went to the museum there where the whole event is commemorated. And it's amazing to see how the city has recovered and grown. The importance of history is to tell us the lessons of the past and serve as a reminder that the past should not be repeated. The building, you know, the Aloy Bridge is still standing. It's a little bit bigger now, of course, because the city's grown and the population has grown. But the building above which the little boy bomb detonated is still standing. It was standing after the bombing. If you look at maps and photos pre and post bombing, there are like maybe three or four buildings left standing after the initial blast. When that one building still stands, has not been torn down, has not been removed, has not been changed, it has been left there as a reminder of the world we live in and the past that we all share. It sits on the edge of a river, the river that the Aloy Bridge goes over, left there decrepit, fenced off. People are unable to go over there and explore. And it sits right across the river from the Peace Bell, which was created and installed as a sign of, I guess you could say, reconciliation or remembrance with Japan, that we will strive, and a promise that we will strive towards a nuclear de-armed world and a peaceful world where we all can coexist. I know it can seem very tough in days like we have going around us right now to think about peace and kindness. We live in very uncertain times. You know, our parents and grandparents lived in the Cold War. Those before them lived through World War. We live in this almost constant state of worry, and it's almost like we're on a knife's edge. But that bell and this, the ability to remember these things, you know, it was very easy to write the script for this show because of all the information we have and the recollections and memories of people that have been recorded and kept safe. So we can remember, so we can look back at the past and understand the world we live in. And that bell is part of that. There's actually this beautiful setup. The path towards the Hiroshima Museum, you come off the road and there's a parking lot. You walk towards the Peace Bell and you stand there, listen to it ring and stare over at the building across the way, thinking about that day in 1945. And then you walk down this path by these ever-burning flames. And if you stand at the doors of the Hiroshima Museum and look towards the Peace Bell, you can see this line of flames kind of framing this bell, and it's this beautiful sight to behold. I'm not afraid to admit that when I was 17 and at the Hiroshima Museum, I shed quite a few tears while I was there. It is a very powerful place to be, to see the remnants of people's lives, to see silhouettes of people that no longer are here, scorched into the remains of walls because of the heat of the blast. If you don't know how the devastation from a nuclear blast works, you have the initial explosion, the concussive force and heat radiating out. Then you have a heat wave that follows. And then you've got kind of the dust clouds and the nuclear fallout. Because you kind of get hit multiple times by a nuclear blast. It's not just, you know, like when a grenade goes off and it's a bang with some shrapnel. It is in a very quick succession, waves that rush over you with such speed and energy and heat that it vaporizes things. It vaporized people and left silhouettes burned into concrete. And for days after, the rains would come down black, filled with soot and dirt and radiation coming down, leaving long black stains on everything that was left. And I want to reiterate that this episode is not meant to condemn Tibbetts. It's not meant to condemn Robert Oppenheimer or anybody involved with the Manhattan Project, the dropping of nuclear weapons, wars of any kind. The intention of this episode and this series really is to show you the lives of people that have done these extraordinary things. These terrifying things in this case. You can think back to the image of young Paul Jr. in this, you know, crop duster flying over top of a carnival, dropping, you know, blue sky, dropping little parachutes filled with candy bars, and juxtapose that with 30 or 18 or so years later, and he's flying over cloudy skies in Hiroshima, Japan, in a plane emblazoned with his mother's name on the side, dropping one of the most devastating weapons known to man at the time. History is strange. I want you to know that this man could have been any of us. He didn't live an extraordinary life. He wasn't a bad person. He didn't grow up with dreams of laying waste to an entire city. He's just a kid that wanted to fly. He wanted to serve his country. For a while, he wanted to do surgery on people's stomachs. He's just a guy. Just like the soldiers who fight for this country, they're just men and women, like us. They lived their lives, they played sports, they went to school, they had friends and families. But they're just like us. Everybody's capable of something, given the right circumstances, the right motivations. People are capable of anything, for good or for bad. And the point of this episode and the point of this series is to show you all listening that everybody, you know, was somebody at some point. Everybody you hear about, read about in history books, they grew up. They lived a life before they did what they did to have their names etched in the annals of history. And Paul Tibbetts Jr. is no different. He's just a kid that liked to fly. It's just that this one kid who liked to fly went on to drop a nuclear bomb. He's not a bad guy. I know that's a strange thing to say when you've just been talking about a guy killing being a major part of killing 134,000 people. He's a soldier. With his orders. He was doing what he thought was right. And as I said, what is right and wrong changes with context and history and understanding and knowledge. We can sit here now and for various reasons stand beside Tibbetts and say that he did his duty, or to condemn him for having a hand in killing thousands of people. I don't want to take a side on either of those things. I have my own feelings on nuclear weapons and war. I'm not going to pick a side. But I just wanted to show you all that I wanted to show you the lives that people live and what kind of person is chosen or is given the opportunity to do something like that. You're going to hear a lot of stories about average people who, you know, they're not the son of some general, or they're not the daughter of some president or prime minister or emperor or empress. They're just normal people who grew up and did something extraordinary. And that is Let's Talk About. I've got about a few minutes left, so this is kind of a reintroduction of the show. Obviously starting with a kind of downer topic, obviously, the bombing of Hiroshima. Not the best way to start with a new time slot, but here we are. So this is a show I've been doing since, if anybody is new listening to this, at 11 o'clock, 11:24 on a Tuesday, listening live. This is a show where I take kind of any topic that I think is important or that's talked about a lot in news or online, and I try and distill it down to something understandable. You know, cut out all of the politics, the rhetoric, the theoretical complexities of it all, and bring it down and explain it in a way that can be understood by the average person. There's amazing work being done by academics and historians and, you know, journalists, and a lot of it is not understandable. You need to take it and repackage it in a way that people will understand, and that's what I hope to do here. So if you're listening right now, listening live right now, even if you're listening on Spotify, because the podcast is available on Spotify now, this is the show. Basically, this is what I do. I'm going to come here and do every Tuesday, whether it's pre-recorded or I'm live in studio. This is what I'm going to do. So I'm Jason Pajak. Hello, audience. So yeah, that's what this show is going to be. The next few episodes are going to be more stories about, you know, obviously war stories. This is the new series that I'm running. So if you have any suggestions, any stories you want me to cover, even like a large event, you know, if you want me to talk about the Battle of the Somme, if you know there's one person from the Battle of the Somme or the Battle of Passchendaele that you want me to talk about, you know, just drop me a tweet. You know, you can follow me on Twitter at Jason Pajak, that's my name. So send me a tweet. And yeah, if you've got suggestions for that or for a topic, then feel free to reach out and, you know, give me something to talk about. That's the name of the show. Let's talk about. And I promise eventually I'm going to have a happier topic for you all. That was just that this story really stuck with me. Because I've been there, I've been to Hiroshima, and I've seen everything. But just the little touches where history winks at us. It does this every once in a while. The fact that his plane is named after his mother, the juxtaposition of him as a child dropping candy bars versus him dropping a nuclear bomb. The fact that one of the planes that joined Tibbetts on his mission was called the Necessary Evil. One of the things that nuclear weapons have been described as in the past is a necessary evil to end that war. History. The fact that he got married Holy Trinity, Alabama, and he was the man that took the bomb from the Trinity test and was the one to drop it on a population. It's these little things where history looks at us and winks with a wink and a nod and says, hey, pay attention. I'm doing something here. So I want to tell more stories like this. Also, I just figured this out. I was looking at my script, and his wife's maiden name is Wingate. Take the 8 out. It's Wing. And he's a pilot. I don't know. History does weird things. I'm going to leave it there. So thank you very, very much for listening. Next up, if you're listening to this live, you've got Tobin Tuesday coming up next, I believe. So we'll see what Joe has for you all on this episode of Tobin Tuesday. He's been doing some great, great work at the Manitoban. I'm actually wearing my Manitoban sweater right now. So you can follow me on Twitter at Jason Pajak. The show is now available on Spotify. I'm working on getting it on Apple Podcasts. The recording, if you joined late, the recording of this episode is going to be up in about an hour. Hour, give or take. So you can listen to it there. Listen to it on Spotify. Tune in live Tuesday, 11 to 11:30 every single week. I will be here talking at you about a different topic. So thank you very, very much for listening, whether you're listening live or on the in the past or in the future on Spotify or umfm.com. I'm Jason Pajak. You are the audience. Thank you very, very much for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day.